This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Keeping the Faith. My name is Don Nolan. I'm filling in for Steve this afternoon. He is out of town. Our guest this afternoon is Reverend Ron Kirby, who is Associate Director at the Wesley United Church and Wesley Foundation. He's also a campus minister, and he just spent, well, not just, a little while ago, spent a year volunteering at the Christian Care Foundation for Children with Disabilities in Thailand. And he is here to talk to us about his experiences with that organization and also his observations and involvement with Thai families and with Buddhism in that country. Reverend Kirby, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Good evening. Thank you so much for having me on. It's always a pleasure having your listeners tie into some of the good things that are happening out there.
Appreciate you you coming. Let's talk a little bit about, first of all, your background at Wesley United Methodist Church and Foundation. You've been there for how long?
I'm in my ninth year now. And eight of those I was there, and then during the 2010-2011 academic year was when we took a sabbatical leave to go to Thailand.
And as I understand it, your wife had an appointment there. Is that right?
In Thailand, one of the ways that we were able to finance it was through her working full-time when we went to Thailand. So she actually sought out a job, and our ability to go there was in many ways contingent upon her doing that. But fortunately, English speakers are in much demand around the world right now, especially teachers.
And she was an English teacher, as I understand it?
Correct. She was teaching first grade.
And are these mostly Thai children or that she taught?
She was at a brand new international school in Nantaburi. It was called Hampton International School. It was based on the Californian system. So they were just getting started. So they had preschool classes, kindergarten class, first grade class, and then a fourth, sixth grade class combined. And when she was there, she was brought in to that first grade class. Real small. There were about six children in her class, one or two, I guess you'd call them full-blooded Thais, and then three or four kind of mixed nationality children where it would be one Thai parent and one international. We had Scottish and just kind of mixed match.
And what was the town again?
It's called Nantaburi, Thailand. That's actually the province. It's upriver of Bangkok. One province north of there, and we are in a community called Pakret.
Where did you go to school before you went into the ministry?
Certainly. I started at, I hate to say this to our Illinois listeners, but I started at Purdue University. Spent a year there studying engineering, and very much felt like engineering wasn't for me. It's one of those things, I was good at it, but it just wasn't for me. I was bored stiff with it.
So did you hide a couple of weekends ago?
No, it's all good. Yeah, most of my family are Purdue grads, so we get into that sometimes. But then I transferred to University of Evansville, where I completed my undergraduate degree in pre-theology and interpersonal communications. Took a couple years off, and then went on to get my Master's of Divinity at Boston University.
At Boston. And is this your first appointment, Wesley, or were you somewhere before?
It's my second appointment. I served 5 years in Moline, Illinois, at a number of churches there. The last one was called Riverside United Methodist Church. And then 9 years ago, the bishop appointed me here.
Right. How did you and your wife get interested in going to Thailand in particular?
I get that question a lot. For people who know us, they actually step one step further back from that and begin the question with, why did you adopt from Thailand? We actually have three adopted children. All of them are Thai. And Darcy and I had always wanted to start a family, and we talked about doing it through adoption and through international adoption. And as we started looking at that process, there were a handful of countries that kind of fit us demographically. There's a lot of requirements that various countries have for their adoptive parents. And as we looked at the ones that best fit us, Thailand was an obvious choice. My parents lived there for a number of years right before I was born, and her father had lived in Thailand as well.
My goodness.
So we had lots of connections. We both grew up with all kinds of Thai artifacts in the house.
Yeah.
And we love Thai food. We think it's the best cuisine in the world. So it was a pretty easy choice for us there.
So you adopted before you went there?
Correct. Okay. We had adopted my son 10 years ago. He was almost 2 years old when we adopted him. And then we adopted twin daughters 8 years ago. Mm-hmm. And both those times we'd gone over to the country to actually finalize the adoption and spend a little bit of time traveling. Then we did do one other heritage visit for a couple weeks that we took our children to. But we always kind of dreamed of getting to know the culture a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
When you're someplace for a week or two, you get to see some things, but you can only get so far off of the tourist track that
right.
way.
Well, we're going to talk more with Reverend Rob Kirby about Thailand and his year there with his wife and getting to know Thai families, working with them and with people who had volunteered at the Christian Care Foundation for Children with Disabilities in a town a little ways north of Bangkok, and also hopefully a little bit about Buddhism, Theravada Buddhism in particular. And if you'd like to call in to ask Reverend Kirby a question or you have a comment, this is a call-in show. You can call in at 333-9455. There's also an 800 number, 1-800-222-9455. So in the process of deciding to go to Thailand, I assume you took all three children with you for the year. Did you talk with your children ahead of time about what the experiences would be like? What you were did you and your wife have a plan for their being there? I would imagine a lot of thought went into this as you prepared for it with your family, given what you just said.
Yeah, absolutely. Darcy and I had actually been dreaming about it for about 7 years. We'd always kind of known we wanted to do an extended time abroad, and it just happened that it would all be in Thailand. But a couple years out, we started baiting the children a little bit, asking them questions like, "Yeah, what do you think it would be like if we actually lived in Thailand?" We've had a number of Thai exchange students, high school students, come and live with us for the course of a year. And so we knew a lot about Thai culture going into it. But again, you get a different side when you look from the outside in versus kind of going in and living
right.
there.
Well, that had to be interesting for your children with your visiting Thai students, getting to know their culture from afar, and then going there. What was that like for them?
It was an adventure. I think it was an adventure for all of us. We were caught off guard by some things. The heat was one.
You're not far from the equator, are you?
No, we're not. Well, Thailand is north of the equator, but mm-hmm. You definitely feel the heat there. They call the seasons hotter and hottest, or sometimes hot, hot and wet, and really hot and wet.
Always humid, right?
Yes.
It's not a dry season?
They do have something that they call the dry season. I don't think we would call it dry here in this. It's a right. relative term that they use there. And if you've been following the news at all, you know it has not been dry there at all
right.
lately.
And right. So when you got there, your wife had the appointment ahead of time at the international school. Is that correct?
Correct.
And then you saw this agency the Christian Care Foundation for Children with Disabilities after you had gotten there and got involved in that after you'd gotten there. Is that right?
Correct. She had secured the teaching position pretty soon before we had gone over, so I hadn't had a lot of time to do much searching. And there's not that much web presence at some of these places. So even as I was doing web searches, particularly English language web searches, I wasn't finding a whole lot. And went over there with the understanding I'd find some way to contribute in service there. Mm-hmm. The Wesley Foundation was very gracious in trusting me in that. And I think God provided. We got there, found her school, and was at one of the local churches there and happened to bump into another volunteer who worked at that orphanage. A week or two later, I went to visit it, and I was hooked. I was really blown away by some of what they were doing there.
Mm-hmm. And what was so moving to you? We talked a little bit before the program, and you made the comment about how much compassion you had seen there for these children.
Yeah, absolutely. The place we were working for, you keep calling it Christian Care Foundation for Children with Disabilities, which is correct. It's much easier to say CCD.
Okay.
And that's what it's known there in the community as, is simply CCD.
It is an orphanage.
Yes, and more than that. And that's part of what really impressed me about what they're doing is it's not just about housing some children. They started with that. They started taking a handful of disabled children or children with disabilities from some of the government orphanages and housing them.
Are they well equipped to deal with these disabilities?
CCD is. They work really hard, and in comparison to the government wards, it's like night and day. Mm. The Thai government does a pretty good job of housing and clothing and feeding the children, but there are just huge orphanages. The community we're living in, Pakret, is kind of the central location where all orphans with disabilities anywhere in Thailand get brought.
I see.
So right there in that little village community we were in, there were 8 or 9 government orphanages with between 600 and 1,000 children in each one.
What accounts for the number? Is it connected with strife in the region at all?
No, actually.
Poverty?
A lot of it is directly associated with poverty. And the reality is Thailand's a large enough country with a sizable population. Oh. But the issue becomes all the children were being brought there. It was a model that was built upon the understanding that if you can bring these children with special needs together, you might be able to have special needs providers there. Mm-hmm. Locally. And there's a couple of hospitals there that specialize with children with various disabilities. But the reality is the government is pretty stretched in their ability to care for the children.
Mm-hmm.
And the wards that the children were on, you'd see 80 to 100 children in a big empty room with a lot of beds in it.
Uh-huh.
And the kids were there about 23 hours a day.
Now, there were several volunteers from abroad, young people, coming to work there that you work with. Is that right?
Correct. CCD is a Thai organization. It has a Thai founder, but they receive a lot of funding from international places, and they bring in a lot of specialists and volunteers from mostly Western countries. There's a lot of presence in England. England and Great Britain has a strong tradition of gap years where a college student might take a year off,
mm-hmm.
Either before, during, or right after their college years, a year of service. So a lot of volunteers were coming with that. A number from Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, and a handful from America as well.
Mm-hmm.
But they then work alongside Thai staff. All of the paid employees are Thai persons. Most of the volunteers are coming in with interest in music therapy, physical therapy, or various other kind of supportive needs that mm-hmm. they kind of wrap around the Thai staff.
Now, where did your kids spend their year? I assume there's a school there that they're in.
Yeah, and to make
how many kids again? Just to review, three?
I have three children. Uh-huh.
What were their ages during this year?
My son was 11, and my daughters were 9.
Mm-hmm.
And again, to make it work financially, they had to have their schooling provided at my wife's school. So part of her contract allowed her children to go there without any fee associated with that. So they all were able to attend there and got an adequate education there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it was academically their most challenging year. But in terms of life experience and what they were able to do.
And they're back here now, and where do they go to school?
My son is at Edison Middle School. He's a 7th grader, so he missed his 6th grade year there. And my daughters are at Westview.
Uh-huh. And I assume that they get to talk about Thailand in their classes at school a lot, right?
A little bit. I mean, at that age, a year is forever. So so much of their context definitely is wrapped up within that year. And it's a little bit of a balancing act for them, knowing when to share and when people are like, all right, let's just get on with life here in the U.S.
Now, you say you work with a number of the volunteers at the CCD, the Christian Care Foundation. What would be some of the more significant stresses or issues that they would face? These would be British, American, Australian, mostly English-speaking?
Correct.
Volunteers? These are young people for the most part, right?
Yes. Most of them are young adult age, somewhere between the ages of 18 and 25. There at CCD, we operate in two languages, in Thai and English.
Mm-hmm.
So to work there, you had to speak
Thai?
One or the other. Neat noi, a little tiny bit. And I need to apologize to any of our listeners for my horrible Thai. It is a challenging language, to say the least,
mm-hmm.
but we managed to get by.
I understand English is challenging to South Asian people as well to learn for the first time. But you were saying your work with the volunteers.
Sure. Some of it came with seeing the condition of some of the orphans and some of the orphanages. It's really hard to see children who won't get out of bed all day and very rarely will have ever leave the walls of that orphanage. And many of them are coming from backgrounds where they've worked with children with disabilities, where many of our Western countries have gotten much better at recognizing potential in kids.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, many of the children there, there just wasn't enough care for someone to identify what some of their potential was. And to move them along. So a lot of it was that stressor,
mm-hmm.
just
mm-hmm.
the reality of the condition of the children.
Seeing the suffering,
knowing that that suffering could be eased, if not alleviated, it could definitely be eased. And then the challenge of helping one child and another child not getting that help.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes that was out of our control. Oftentimes that was the government orphanage workers who would choose which children kind of got the golden ticket where they were allowed to participate in some
right.
enrichment. And then there's just stressors with the culture, trying to learn how to navigate through a culture with a different set of values, maybe not better or worse, but definitely different. Like many Southeast Asian cultures, it's a very face or shame averse culture.
Right.
So there's a lot of song and dance that goes along with that. And for some of us Western folk, we don't know how to do that, and it can be really challenging trying to get a straight answer out of someone sometime.
So avoidance of conflict, I think, is remarkable from what I've heard in Thailand especially.
And there's an upside of that. Everywhere you go, people are smiling. Even as I've watched some of the flooding pictures, you know, you'll see Thais wading through the water with big, broad smiles on their faces. And that's just another way that they don't show anything that might be shame related in any way or conflict related. It's an easy culture to live in. People are some of the most gracious people I've ever met, are Thai persons. But as a Westerner who's used to hearing it straight sometimes you just want to hear it straight.
Right. Just give me the bottom line.
Unfortunately, sometimes they would speak from that perspective, and egos would get bent on both sides, and then finding ways to kind of ease some of that discord that occasionally arises.
Did you have to deal with certain conflicts yourself, or did you observe that happening?
Certainly.
Between Westerners and Thai?
All the time. For me, it seemed like most of it got played out with my landlord. Just struggling to figure out how to communicate across some of those cultural differences, whether it was a landlord who, you know, if I ever had an issue with the house that I needed attended to, he would take offense, but I wouldn't know he had taken offense if I had mentioned something needed to be repaired, because for him it was me saying that what he was providing was not good enough. Invariably it would take me a week or two to even realize that I had offended him. And then the reality of trying to get the thing fixed. By and large, you work through it.
Well, just to remind our listeners, we're talking to Reverend Rob Kirby, who is the Associate Director at the Wesley Foundation, Wesley United Methodist Church and Wesley Foundation. He's also campus minister there. He recently took a year off to go to Thailand with his wife and three adopted Thai children, and had some extremely interesting experiences with the culture there and also with an organization that he spent time with, volunteering at the Christian Care Foundation for Children with Disabilities. And we're going to talk a little bit more about his experiences, particularly with Buddhism and the culture in Thailand. If you're interested in talking with Reverend Kirby about his experiences, you can call in at 333-9455. There's also an 800 number, 1-800-222-9455. Well, how did your children adjust to the culture after they were there? I assume since you had several foreign students from Thailand in your home before then, and you had three children from Thailand that you had adopted, they were pretty well prepared, but were there any shocks or downsides that they had to come to terms with once they got there? I'm sure there must have been some.
Certainly. They are troopers. They embrace adventure. And I think part of it, we've tried to raise them that way. But I think part of it's just who they are. I guess like many children of 9, 10, or 11 years old, a lot of their life revolves around food. I think my son went into peanut butter withdrawal. I think we tried to hoard whatever peanut butter we got.
Couldn't find any there, huh?
Well, you can find it, but it's priced a little bit differently than here.
Okay.
In fact, one time we went to the supermarkets, and for whatever reason, Thais have shortages of things sometimes, and sometimes those shortages are brought on by illegitimate scares. And apparently someone heard that the peanut butter shipments were down in Thailand. So they announce it, so everyone buys peanut butter, and lo and behold, they're out of peanut butter. So we went to one of our local grocery stores.
We have that at a slightly different level in Wall Street, I think, maybe.
Exactly. Ours is exactly. Our commodity tends to get played out by the price of things. But we went to one of our local stores in the midst of this, and where the peanut butter normally would have been, they had these little plexiglass safes. And in each safe was a jar of peanut butter. And you had to go take that to the manager, who would get a key and unlock your jar of peanut butter and hand it to you as you bought it.
Good gracious. So maybe you should have invested in peanut butter. We have a caller on line one. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. You have a question or comment for Reverend Kirby?
I think I have a question. And I think I may be jumping ahead. But here is the question. You said that the Thai culture was a shame-averse culture. And I was just wondering, I know you can't generalize about things like this, but what do parents think when they have a disabled child? I mean, do they think it's karma or something to be embarrassed about? I know parents in the West sometimes think, well, God is doing this to me for some reason. And I'll just hang up. Thank you.
Very good question. Thank you for your question, Reverend Kirby.
Thank you for striking at that. Yes, on one level, there is a certain amount of embarrassment that goes with that. But before I go into that too much, I want to name that we're there in that in this country as well, that oftentimes parents are embarrassed by things that happen to them or their families. Even if you go back in our country 20, 30 years ago, most children with disabilities would not have been mainstreamed. They would have been pulled out into specialty schools, and it's not necessarily unique to their culture. But you are right. Buddhism does give a certain twist to some of this, and it's not necessarily the Buddhism that a good Buddhist theologian might give you, but as it's practiced on the street, there is a sense that there's karma at work in this. And as a parent, if you end up with a child with some form of disability, it may very well reflect on you and something you have done or something you have not done. Additionally, it reflects on the child.
So the parent's karma.
Absolutely.
Oh.
Because it is a life circumstance that has unfolded in their lives, and as such, that can be a piece of karma or interpreted as a piece of karma for them. And also with the children. Within our culture, we tend to think of all children as being innocent, but they're the vast majority of people who you might engage in dialogue with. When you get right down to it, they'll say that this child's suffering is probably somehow related to a former life.
Mm-hmm. Of
the child, exactly. That somehow, as they were reincarnated, they were brought back in a more challenged situation, a situation of lower status.
Did you have conversations with any monks or any Thai parents about that?
With a number of Thai parents, many of the parents that we were working with, we work really hard to proclaim the potential and the grace and the love that is within each of those children. By the time most of them were able to speak with me, they had wrestled with those issues already. Certainly, as some of my colleagues, one of the things I was doing was teaching ESL through a church program, and got to work with a number of Thais in that
ESL
setting.
English as a second language.
Correct. And that's one of the questions I'd often query them with. And yes, and they don't necessarily think that they should bring further punishment to that child. It's almost – that's the way it is,
mm-hmm.
And that there's nothing particularly wrong with that. My sense is in the government orphanages, sometimes it gets played out almost at the level of we need to care for this child, but ultimately release will come at death when they get reborn into a better life.
Mm-hmm.
And that that there's just a certain reality that this is where the child is.
Mm-hmm.
And our job is to feed this child, to treat the child humanely, but also not a lot of high expectations for what that child might achieve.
And you see, you don't use the word resignation, but is that a correct word to use to describe the people who are thinking this way about these children? Is it a resignation that helping them find their fuller potential is not something worth doing? Or is that not fair?
It's almost like the potential is not there. The resignation almost means a lowering of an expectation, or we'll settle for that. My sense is it's a step beyond that of this is the lot of life. It's not a fatalism wouldn't be the right word either.
Right.
Just the reality of the world and
realism. But I think that within that theology, they could make the case that that a given child's potential could be maximized, even though they were realistic about their limits. Isn't that fair? I mean, it's
I think that would be fair. And as I spoke with some of the monks that I was able to dialogue with, they were able to articulate very compassionate, very loving embraces. Of those children, but you wouldn't always see it acted out upon either in the orphanages or even with some of the parents. Occasionally you'd have parents who some of it is they haven't seen what some of these children can achieve.
I was going to say that may be more ignorance of the therapies available to children with disabilities than it is a theological bias. Would that be fair?
Correct. But sometimes I think those do go hand in hand.
Do they?
Having said that, Thais are loving people. I mean, they see that and they get that. Some of it is they haven't had it well modeled in their arena of disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes, mm-hmm. children with disabilities are hidden away, and some of it gets back to that shame that perhaps it reflects on who I am as a parent or who this child is. So this organization I was working with, CCD, one component was the orphanage where we housed about 30 children. But we also had CBR sites, community-based rehab sites, where we would go into local villages and try and work in locations where there were disabled children at risk of being given up to the government. And we would try and build these centers to provide physical therapy, to provide enrichment. But I think one of the biggest blessings we brought into those communities was parent networks.
Mm-hmm.
We worked really hard to build up parent network groups where they could talk with each other, where they could share with each other, where they could see each other's successes and trials. And those CBR sites were literally transforming lives and communities. We had those operating in three different provinces, about 9 or 10 different sites.
That you created or were already there?
They were created through CCD, their CCD
while sites. You were there?
While I was there, I think they added 3.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
So this was an ongoing
correct.
Process.
Mm-hmm. Correct. So that's one of the major areas CCD.
And you described that as a stopgap to prevent them from going into government agencies.
Correct. Twofold. One is to try and prevent them from parents giving their children up for adoption.
I see.
And you did name that oftentimes it's an economic crisis. The reality is the children with some of these disabilities that they need a caregiver 24/7. Mm-hmm. And so you can't go out and get a job, or if you do have a job, you can't really pay for the child care. So we were providing child care in these centers so that parents could drop the children off and they could go to work. Just finding ways to be there in those communities. The other thing that was happening was the children not only were being separated from their parent or their guardian, but also from the village community that they were being brought up in.
Support system and network.
Of aunts mm-hmm. and uncles, mm-hmm. of the broader community that when given the opportunity will reach out and support. Mm-hmm. So a lot of what we're trying to do is find ways to keep those kids from ever being shipped to Pakrat and removed from that community.
What's the name again? Shipped to?
Pakrat. Was uh-huh. the name of the village where these orphanages were in the province of Nantaburi.
And to avoid going there.
Correct.
That's where the government warehousing, was it more like a warehousing, or is that not fair?
Perhaps a little unfair. Centralized there. But the reality is once children were sent there, their contact with their local communities that they were coming out of was essentially broken.
And you gave some numbers earlier. Do you know what we're talking about in terms of the number of children that are in Pakrat?
Sure. There are 8 or 9 government orphanages. Each orphanage is between 500 and almost 1,000 children each.
I see.
So we're talking 5,000-6,000 children. Mm-hmm. Right there in that community. Mm-hmm. Now, that is most of the disabled children, disabled orphans in Thailand. Very few of them remain in their local communities.
Well, you also, I understand, got to know some families. What were some of the families that you knew, and what did you find out about their family life that was similar to yours or different or what?
People are people anywhere you go, and that's part of what I love about traveling is realizing that there's a resilience among people everywhere, that there is a love that can be shared. We had a little bit of head start going there in that two of our exchange students were living there. They had been in high school. One of them had just graduated from college.
Exchange students that had lived with you?
With us, exactly. Ah. The high school, they'd come and spent a year of their high school with us.
I see.
And had gone back to Thailand. They
had gone back and you then went back?
And then when we went over to Thailand, we were able to spend a lot of time with them.
Wow.
One of them terminology she used was she wasn't unemployed, she was free, which, of course, Thailand is called the land of the free, and one interpretation of the word Thai is free. So she was free, which meant she had a fair amount of time on her hands, so we were able to spend a lot of time with her. She's a devout Buddhist. She was one of my sounding boards as I was struggling with a dissonance in terms of what I would see a Buddhist practice versus a Buddhist teaching. She was my go-to person.
Mm-hmm.
It was wonderful engaging her in conversation. She,
how old was she?
She would have been about 22.
Okay.
Every week she would give merit. She had 2 or 3 monks that she would make sure that she would connect with.
You might want to describe giving merit.
Yeah. Some Westerners will go to a Buddhist country and see these saffron-robed monks begging on the streets. If you tell that to a Thai, they will take offense. These monks are not begging. They are walking with their alms bowls, giving opportunity for people to make merit. Or in other words, providing an opportunity for Buddhist persons to act upon their faith. And one of the ways that they act upon their faith is making merit. In some ways, it is a way of earning good karma. It is a way of following the Eightfold Path. So by making merit, they The monks would be walking the streets, and they would be approached by a Thai person with an offering, usually a food offering, sometimes a monetary offering. Thai lay person would take off their shoes out of respect, often would kneel or would bow down, would weigh to the monk, and then would place an offering in the alms bowl, and then the monk would say a blessing of some sort, which is kind of what I'd read in the books. But I also saw a lot of street counseling that would go on there. Hmm. Oftentimes, they would approach the monk with a problem that they were struggling with. And some of the monks that I was able to witness, you could tell that they were doing far more than just reciting an answer, but were in dialogue with the person and the issues that they were facing. So that's a regular part of Thai daily.
This would be
life.
On the streets.
It would be everywhere.
I see.
Officially, it is on the streets. The monks are supposed to only have their robe,
right.
An alms bowl, and a little satchel to carry whatever donations might be given to them. But they would get trapped anywhere. Uh-huh. Sometimes they'd be on an overpass up over one of the roads, and they'd receive the alms there. Sometimes it would be on a subway car. It could be anywhere. They're receiving their only meal of the day at that time. The monks there believe that they should not have anything to eat after midday. So their major meal is in the morning. Sometimes they'd snack a little bit around lunchtime. But it's a wonderful part of Thai life that gets lost on tourists. Oftentimes they don't wake up before the sun, and they're missing out.
Right.
One of the things I always try and do when we travel over there and I'm struggling with jet lag is take advantage of that jet lag. And while I'm waking up early, is just get up and enjoy the life that mm-hmm. happens before the sun.
We are talking with Reverend Rub Kirby this afternoon on Keeping the Faith. Reverend Kirby is Associate Director at the Wesley Foundation here on campus. He's also a campus minister. And he spent a year along with his wife and three adopted Thai children whom he adopted before he went to Thailand and then went there. And he's talking with us about his rather complicated set of experiences with your children, with you and the Christian Care Foundation for Children with Disabilities, and his wife's experience at the international school teaching English. Fascinating year, and he is here to talk to us about that, and we're now talking about Buddhism. And if you're interested in making a comment, we have about 15 minutes left. You can call in and put a question to Reverend Kirby. The number is 333-9455. There's also an 800 number, 1-800-222-9455. We were talking about the monks and the early morning rounds. I assume you have heard that in Myanmar, as I understand it, because the monks have been resistant, politically resistant, for a variety of reasons to the regime there, that increasing numbers of citizens are reluctant to give merit. Have you heard about that? This is Myanmar, the country immediately to the west of Thailand where you're at. I'm just wondering if there's any spillover or any talk about that while you were there?
Not a whole lot. I got stranded at a bus station with a Burmese monk. And he was dressed in his saffron robes. He looked like a Thai monk, but he didn't speak a word of Thai. So I actually became his translator, mm-hmm. Which I failed at miserably. But he spoke some English, and he and I had some wonderful conversations about some of his struggles there in Myanmar. And It's a different situation. We get a lot of Burmese refugees coming into Thailand. There is some exchange of monks back and forth. Completely different political system. Within Thailand, the...
You mean between the two countries or between the two Buddhist traditions?
Between the two countries. They're,
okay.
they're both going to share a commonality. They'd both be Theravada Buddhism. But in Thailand, the Singha, the order of monks, is officially recognized as a department of the state. Mm. So the religious nature of Buddhism is side by side with the political system in Thailand, and so you won't see much political action on the monks' part in any way against the government or. Really, I didn't see much political action in Thailand, which is, of course—
It's not as oppressive politically, is it, as in Myanmar?
Oh, no, absolutely not. Yeah, completely
it's more
different.
More benign arrangement, not completely just, but less oppressive, I understand.
Yes, absolutely. They do limit the freedom of speech in several ways that that as Americans we find a little shocking, but in that part of the world it's not uncommon. By and large, Thais are remarkably free to practice religion as they see fit, to voice certain political views, where in Myanmar those would be very much restricted. And one of the reasons that the monks do it there is they have just a little bit more freedom than some of the lay people to be able to voice that.
Right. We have a caller on line one. You have a question or comment for Reverend Kirby. Hello, line one.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. So my name is Katie, and I'm asking him, what was his favorite—
I think we lost you. Try again. Maybe if you can call back in again, we can get a better connection. It sounded like you had an interesting question, so we'll hopefully hear from you if you call back in again. So you have had several interesting conversations as a Christian minister with your own theological training. Did you come away with some new understandings of Theravada Buddhism, particularly with respect to their view toward compassion? It's often the contrast between agape Christian love and Buddhist emphasis on compassion, almost cosmic in many countries, but in Theravada, take it, it's a little bit more community-based. What changes in your understanding of that topic did you come back with, or were there other areas theologically that you were impressed by?
I'll be honest. As I first went over there, I studied Buddhism out of a book, and it never seemed to fit with what I saw on the street. What I saw on the street was a lot of what I'd call animism, a lot of understanding that there are spirits in trees and rocks, and
right.
and so much of the overt expression of faith seemed to be more animistic or more Hindu-related often than Buddhist-related. Thais will not make that distinction. It's all rolled up into
right.
one way of life where it's all integrated. They don't pull their lives apart quite as much as we do in terms of, you know, this is secular and this is religious. So it was fun watching them live out various pieces of their faith.
All right. Caller on line one again, I hope. You have a question or comment for Reverend Kirby.
Hi, I'm Mel Kirby, and I'm wondering what was Robert's favorite part in Thailand?
My favorite part, and I do need to let our listening audience know that the former caller apparently was Katie Kirby, and this is Nell Kirby, two persons who were along for the ride on the adventure. Some of my favorite pieces. I guess, Nell, you saw one of them. It was when an elephant stepped on my foot.
Your foot.
My foot. We were up in Ayutthaya at the elephant corral, and they had little baby elephants. And we were out playing with the little baby elephants, petting them and feeding them. And one of them just kind of leaned back and stepped on my foot. And I screamed out and gave that elephant as much of a shove as I could, which doesn't do much for an elephant. And he got off me, but my foot was a little sore for a while.
Are you still on the line? Okay. Well, thank you. Well, I see you're not hobbling today.
No. Fortunately, an elephant's foot is pretty big, and even while he was stepping on mine, he was also stepping on the ground a little bit with it.
So you were talking a little bit about your impressions of in Thai religious culture. You said the distinctions between what you described as animism and Buddhism were not drawn or clear, but yet you saw them. How did you see the distinctions? I mean, it's frequently observed in many Asian countries that native religious traditions are quite alive and well and not superimposed, but integrated with Hinduism and Buddhism and other traditions. But you said you could see the distinction. How were you able to see that?
Some places you'll see it. You'll see spirit houses at the vast majority of Thai homes, as well as most businesses, where they'll have a little shrine set up to appease the spirits, I think they call them jinn there, that have been mm-hmm. displaced mm-hmm. As they've moved in. So they will come to these spirit houses. They will make an offering to these spirits so that they don't cause trouble. And then they'll say a Buddhist prayer to these animistic spirits. And for me, it's a conflict. I think some of it, as Christians, we're often taught there's one way and one truth. Buddhism doesn't necessarily adhere to that. Mm-hmm. You uncover the path as it unfolds.
It's one of the most accommodating religions of the world, isn't it? As it moves from one culture to the other.
Absolutely. And Thais don't see that conflict. And because they don't see it, it's not a conflict. And they are still able to practice some of their Buddhist prayers, some of their Buddhist meditations without feeling guilty that they've done something that may not be within their sacred writings. It's a fascinating culture.
When you talk to Thai people about Christianity, I'm sure you've got, during your year there, you got into deeper conversations. How did you present it, and what kind of responses would you get when you described your own faith, for example?
Certainly. Some of the...
By the way, we should mention Thailand is 95% Buddhist and a very small percentage of Christian believers are in the country.
95 to 97% Buddhist, and I read one study, 0.7% Christian. Mm-hmm. Between you and me, I think those numbers aren't accurate.
Right.
I think there's a much larger Christian percentage than that. Uh-huh. Just anecdotally, the number of churches I saw, the number of people I met who are Christian, I suspect that there are reasons that that those numbers might be a little askew.
So would an ordinary Thai family that you would run into know about Christianity, or would they only have discovered it through you, or how well versed were they in other religious traditions, such as Christianity?
Almost all of them would know about Christianity. Okay. Now, granted, I was in some fairly metro areas most of the time that I was there. Most of them have encountered Christianity in several different ways. Of course, most of what they have encountered is a friend of a friend telling them something about it. They watch a lot of Western TV, so they've seen all the sitcoms as they do parodies sometimes on not just Christianity but various faiths. So that's how most of them had encountered it. For many of them, the whole concept of a deistic religion is a whole nother way to look at the world, to imagine a god. Most Buddhists won't pray to a god. They mm-hmm. pray regularly. And I kept asking people, well, who are you praying to?
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't seem to concern them. They know that their tradition taught these prayers and that there was a value to these prayers. And it was a prayer to a truth, a prayer to a teaching, but not to a being.
I understand that within that one of the contrasts between Mahayana, the overwhelmingly larger percentage of Buddhists are Mahayana, China and Tibet and the North, is Theravada Buddhism tends to play down the worship of the Buddha, the tendency to worship the Buddha. Is that fair to say in practice? One of the observations many people I've heard speak of is this contrast or this dissonance, to use your term, between the worship of the Buddha, particularly in Mahayana Buddhism as a bodhisattva,
sure.
and what Buddha actually taught about that. In Theravada, the idea is to be closer to what Buddha taught. Is that right?
Correct. Having said that, it's very ritualized, the practice, whether it's at weddings or funerals or various life events or Buddhist festivals, it becomes very ritualized. And on one level, it looks like worship. And as I first got there, I kept on saying, are you worshiping the Buddha? Are you praying uh-huh. to the Buddha or through the Buddha? And the Buddha instead, or the Buddha carvings or images that you see everywhere, instead are just a focus of attention.
Mm-hmm. Placeholders.
Exactly. So if you question them, most would be very clear that, no, I'm not worshiping to right. or even through this Buddha. It just is a way to get me focused, to provide a placeholder for the truth, for the teachings, for the triple
right.
gem, that Buddhism.
Well, we have one quick call on line one. We have just a couple of seconds here. You have a question or comment? Line one?
Yeah, I just want to call. I study Buddhism actually, and primarily focus on Japan. But it's very common in Theravada Buddhism for there to be veneration of the Buddha's relics, and so what we call worship, it's a bit more complicated than that. But as a mode of meditation and so forth, and great respect, it's really common in that part of the world. One thing I wanted to note as well is that. In Tibet with Bon, and Japan with kami worship, Shinto, this Buddhism accommodating throughout the Buddhist world these other forms is very, very common, and people don't see any kind of problem with that.
Sorry to interrupt you. We took you in late here, but we're really out of time. Thank you for your comment. We've been talking with Reverend Rob Kirby about his year in Thailand. Thank you very much for joining us, Rob.
My pleasure.
See you again next week. Thank you.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.